Right now on the Daily Debrief.
I've got three words for the state. Bring it on.
Yes, bring it on. That's the attorney for a Connecticut man facing a new charge that he played a role in his wife's disappearance. Also,
she didn't want it. She couldn't get rid of it. She researched ways to get rid of it.
The state wanted to send this teen to prison for life on charges she killed her baby.
The only person that gets the benefit of the doubt and the presumption is Skylar.
The jury has a verdict. And a South Carolina man accused of working with his wife to make his girlfriend disappear. Plus, actor Jesse Smollett may be trying to parlay his recent legal issues into a form of art. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Thursday, September 12th.
And welcome to the Debrief, everybody. I am just back from an arraignment for a wealthy Connecticut husband suspected of disposing of bloody evidence of his own wife's disappearance. Fotis Doulos today pleaded not guilty to an additional charge of evidence tampering. His wife, Jennifer, disappeared May 24th, leaving five children behind. Doulos' attorney said early in the case that he suspects Jennifer ran away to avoid a bitter divorce and custody dispute. Court and police records suggest a painstaking investigation, with an official theory that Fotis Doulos waited for his wife to return to her home, attacked her in a garage, cleaned up blood, and then disposed of evidence miles away in Hartford. A man with a criminal record claims he found a knife and a bloody pillow, but that he traded it for cocaine. Here's how Doulos' attorney fought back in court.
Jumped the ball here and plead not guilty. We've had an opportunity to read the warrant. Nothing places Mr. Doulos in that car other than the state's belief. And our view is when the state's got some proof and more than abstract beliefs, it will know where to find us. This business of seriatim arrests on de minimis
stuff. Well, counsel, this is not the time for the closing argument.
Oh, it is a time for it, Judge. It is a time.
If you wish to make a closing argument, counsel, if you wish to make a closing argument, you can wait until after, if there is a trial.
If the state waited before publishing its warrants and having the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety talk about the tests that were out there, we would wait. But since the state can't, we won't. We're eager for this fight, and when the state's ready, bring it.
Well, this is neither the highlight for ESPN.
No, it's a court of law, and we have to sit silently while we read these allegations and warrants and
are cut by 1,000 deaths.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge.
The defense fighting back with the judge right there. Fotis Doulos and his girlfriend, Michelle Traconis, were first accused of tampering with physical evidence and hindering prosecution. Both are felonies in Connecticut. They now face that additional charge after the girlfriend is said to have told police that wife Jennifer's body was in a truck used by Fotis Doulos. Let's begin tonight with former prosecutor Mike Korobanek, criminal defense attorney Brian Buckmeyer, and attorney Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson. So, Gwendolyn, this is the second minor charge this defendant is facing. Why this charge and why now?
Well, I think we have the girlfriend that is actually getting some heat now, okay? So she's basically gonna crack. And typically when you have, you know, a case like this, where you have a girlfriend involved with knowing information about how the defendant and how this husband disposed of the bloody body and evidence that he may have used to kill his wife, that's very significant. So what the prosecution wants to do is they want to just put a lot of pressure on her and get her to crack and get her to turn so that the prosecution can use them again. Use this witness against the defendant.
Brian Buckmeyer, the defense keeps suggesting that Jennifer Doulos is alive and that she disappeared. Is that strategy going to work? And once choosing that strategy, would it be foolish to change course?
So it's pretty early in the case right now to see whether or not it's going to work. We don't know the evidence. We don't know the testimony is going to come out. But if you're going to come out with this strategy early on, you've got to stick with it. Prosecutors can get a little bit of the benefit of the doubt of switching their strategy partway through. But for a defense, it can also be the quickest way to a guilty verdict.
Former prosecutor Mike Korobanek, this mother has been missing since May 24th. Her family says through an attorney that they think that she's dead. Doulos' own attorney, the defendant's attorney, says he expects murder charges basically any day. What are prosecutors potentially waiting for here?
I think what the prosecution's doing with murder charges in a case like this, obviously they know they're going against an aggressive attorney. They want to make sure, see, the prosecution's got a benefit here. They get to put it all together when they're ready. They just have to stay within the statute of limitations. As long as they do that, they're going to make sure that they get this case put together. But more importantly, they're going to play head games with the defense now, thinking that that girlfriend is going to flip on the defendant.
A lot going on in this case. Let's move now to Ohio, where we just saw a late day verdict in the case of a teenager accused of murdering her newborn baby 2 days after her high school prom. Prosecutors claimed Brooke Schuyler Richardson made no follow-up appointments after learning she was pregnant and did nothing to prepare for her baby's arrival. They say she then killed her newborn after giving birth alone at home. Richardson said the baby was stillborn and that she secretly buried its remains because she feared backlash from her community and her parents. Here is the verdict.
With regard to count one, we, the jury in the above captioned case, find the defendant, Brooke Schuyler Richardson, not guilty of the offense of aggravated murder. Verdict form two, involuntary manslaughter. We, the jury in the above captioned case, hereby find the defendant, Brooke Schuyler Richardson, not guilty of the offense of involuntary manslaughter. Count three, child endangerment. We, the jury, find the defendant, Brooke Schuyler Richardson, not guilty of child endangerment. It does say we further find the defendant did not cause serious physical harm to the alleged victim. Verdict form number four, we, the jury, in the above captioned case, find the defendant, Brooke Schuyler Richardson, guilty of the offense of abuse of a corpse.
Let's bring the full panel in again for discussion on this case. Brian Buckmeyer, I'll start with you. Any surprise in the verdict there from where you sit?
No surprise for me. The only thing that I kind of unsettled with is the last verdict of the not guilty. I would have thought this would have been a full acquittal. It's strange. What else would you want her to do other than put her in a mahogany casket and lower her into the ground? But for the rest of the charges, I saw that coming.
Mike Korobanek, I'll ask you the same. The same question here. So, was the conviction on that final charge much of a surprise to you?
No, not really. I think it was sort of a compromise, and I don't agree with it. But I think it was a compromise, and the jury gave the state sort of a gratuitous verdict there.
Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson, I think the defense is probably popping champagne corks at this point. I mean, this was a huge win, beating the top charge and the other two top charges after that.
Well, definitely, absolutely. And I think what's key and critical is that, judging from this particular verdict, the jury believed that this was a stillborn child. And as a result of that, they only had one thing to do, and that was determine whether or not the corpse was abused. And they believed that the corpse was abused. This was a felony charge. It was not a misdemeanor charge. And it's a felony because, according to the Ohio statute, if you dispose of the body, that outrages the sensibility of the community. That was the thing that basically hooked the conviction on that.
It's a rather wishy-washy standard, but the bottom line is that the jury convicted on that final count. And now let's take a look at how the defense wrapped up that case earlier today.
Schuyler's repeated statements in two interrogations, they want you to ignore them, describing a dead baby. Never using the word stillbirth or stillborn, but describing a dead baby. Body just came out of him. She was dead, not breathing, not moving. 17 times denying the fire. Schuyler named her child. She put her in a grave site that she could see from her bedroom window and kept her close, put flowers on her grave and marked the grave, and they continue to talk about concealing and destroying. They want you to ignore your common sense and science that a baby or a human being lights on fire. Lights on fire. I mean, it is sad that they can't even come in here and admit the truth. Indications of a stillbirth. The umbilical cord is the lifeline between the placenta and the fetus. They want you to ignore it. White, medical term for white is pallor. Law says that the only person that gets the benefit of the doubt and the presumption is Schuyler.
The state unsuccessfully tried to press forward for a conviction.
She never told anyone about her child after its death. If it was up to the defendant, Dr. Boyce would have never called the police, and that child would still be 2 inches in the dirt back behind their home. She didn't want it. She couldn't get rid of it. She researched ways to get rid of it. Never told anyone about it. Lied and concealed it. No preparations or planning for it. Upon having it, buried it in the backyard. Destroyed and disposed of any evidence of it. And ladies and gentlemen, the reason I'm using it here as opposed to Brooke's daughter is because that is how Brooke described her daughter throughout the entire first interview. And now she comes to you when she's caught in her web of lies and deception, and she asks you to believe that this was all just luck. All of the stars didn't just align, ladies and gentlemen, for her to have a stillborn child that she didn't want, told no one about, made no preparations for, and concealed and buried her in the backyard, all so that she could maintain the appearance and the image of her perfect life.
The defendant's so-called confession was the state's key piece of evidence in this case. The state argued that the defendant lied and then finally told the truth. The defense argued that the defendant was adamant about not harming the baby and then, after hours of interrogation, admitted to things that weren't true because she was promised leniency.
Tell me everything that you were thinking and everything you did, just so I know, like I was there.
Nothing's going to change what happened, okay? But your intention was to try to free Mayor, so what part did you try to light?
I guess I just...
Part of the remains, like, did you start, like, at the bottom, the top?
How long would be your closest guess how long she was alive? It doesn't change things if it was 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes.
Five minutes that she was alive or 5 minutes that she was in this room?
Maybe she's alive.
I don't know what's going to happen. That is not up to us, okay? I don't know. Do you feel like you keep saying that? Do you feel like you should be
here? I don't think that you should have to do right.
A defense interrogation expert trashed the police tactics you just watched.
The officers in the July 20th interrogation of the defendant used a very aggressive version of the Reed technique.
Can you explain that to the jury?
So, right at the outset, they told Skylar that with medical scientific certainty, her account where the baby was stillborn was false. That is standard confrontation. And then they advanced any number of minimization themes. They led on that the main purpose of this interrogation was a burial for the baby, a proper burial. They told her that they knew she didn't harm the baby deliberately. They said that she had been alone and in shock. These are all fairly typical minimization themes, but they went beyond that. They made two statements that I found particularly problematic. Lieutenant Fain said to her, "It's not as if we're suddenly going to jump up and judge you and say you're going to jail." And Detective Carter said to her, "You just tell us everything and then we can move on." Both of these comments indicate that the suspect will receive zero punishment if she confesses. Not a light sentence, not a benign treatment, but zero punishment. And that is an extreme and particularly troubling minimization tactic.
And that's it problematic, in your view, for what reason?
Because it can break down an innocent person and lead him or her to confess.
Okay, that was the evidence. Former prosecutor Mike Korobanix, the detectives stuck up for themselves and said it took a long time to dig through the defendant's lies. That's what they said on the stand. What do you see in that recording?
I see. I didn't like that recording from first impression. I think Professor Hirsch was an excellent expert witness, and I think he educated not only the jury but all the viewers at Law and Crime about how dangerous confessions are and how you really need something to corroborate a confession, and they didn't have in this case, and the jury spoke.
Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson, the jury watched that. The jury apparently didn't credit it, or if the jury did, didn't believe that it was guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I was very troubled with this because it looked like they were trying to pressure her to lie and say that the baby was alive for 5 minutes, when clearly she was all along saying, you know, even with body language and even with prior words, that, you know, the baby was stillborn, the baby was not alive. And it looked like they were trying to promise her leniency, no charges at all, no jail time. So what else was she gonna do? I mean, it looked like they were trying to offer a plea bargain, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, and the police can't do that. Brian Buckmeyer, how did you see that interrogation? Did you see lies or truth or neither?
I saw a false confession. I think the expert hit the nail on the head. I think Mike Korobonics and I had talked about this last week when we were on the Law and Crime Trial Network. And I think my quote was that the bones of a false confession was there, but the meat needed to be put on it. And I think the expert put the meat on there, and the jury understood the science and came with the right decision.
And still ahead here on The Debrief, actor Jussie Smollett may be using his legal troubles as inspiration for a new line of work. Plus, we're back inside the courtroom for the trial of a South Carolina man accused of making his girlfriend disappear using the help of his wife. Welcome back, everybody. Let's check in with Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross. He's in our newsroom with what's coming up on Brian Ross Investigates.
Thanks, Aaron. 18 years later, the mystery man named in a secret FBI report who allegedly helped two of the 9/11 hijackers carry out their plot. Attorney General Barr has just announced he'll turn over the name to lawyers for the families of the 9/11 victims. One of those lawyers, Andrew Maloney, will join us live here on Brian Ross Investigates, coming up at 5:30, Aaron, right after the Daily Debrief.
We'll see you in just a couple of minutes, Brian. I will certainly be watching. An NFL wide receiver has been hit with a federal civil lawsuit alleging rape. Antonio Brown's accuser says the attacks happened in Pittsburgh and Miami, and even went back to the time she and the pro footballer spent together in college. So far, police are not involved. The NFL attempted to speak to the accuser, but she refused, saying she's going to be married this weekend. Brown says it's a financial shakedown, and the accuser has been after him for some time to help fund a business venture. Actor Jussie Smollett and his sister are reportedly working on a film about a brother and a sister who are falsely accused of committing a crime. That's according to a report by BET, which goes on to say that the movie may be loosely based on Smollett's case. The city of Chicago is suing Smollett for $130,000 police spent investigating an alleged attack on Smollett. Authorities say he made the attack up, but prosecutors refuse to push a criminal case against him. Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson and Mike Korobonics are here in studio. They're going to talk a little bit about this case. So, Mike, Smollett's defense in the civil lawsuit is that he had no idea how much money police would spend investigating his report of a racist and homophobic attack. Is that even logical?
It's mind-boggling, quite frankly, and I just can't. This case just gets more and more arrogant, and it almost says if you just keep repeating the same lie over and over again, it'll become the truth. And that's sort of what it's here. But he better do a better acting job in the movie than he did in real life.
Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson, what are the police supposed to do here? Ignore a report of a possible hate crime on someone famous? Is that what he expected?
I don't know what he expected. It just seems outrageous, the whole thing. And I think what offends the sensibilities here he is trying to profit. He's trying to profit off a situation where you have a story of somebody was falsely accused. He wasn't falsely accused. He made the whole thing up.
Well, again, how closely will fiction track reality if indeed this film gets made? That may be the big question. And now, day two of the trial of Sidney Borer. He's the South Carolina man charged in connection with the disappearance of a woman named Heather Elvis. Borer was dating Elvis, and Elvis has been missing since December 2013, almost 6 years ago. Sidney Borer's wife, Tammy, seen here, was convicted in a separate trial last fall of kidnapping Heather Elvis. In court today, the final text messages between the defendant and the purported victim. Plus, the state can't prove with certainty that the defendant went to the location where authorities theorize Heather Elvis disappeared.
From Heather's phone says, "I think you're a little obsessed with me." Sydney's phone responds, "Nah, it was a bore." And then there's another message to Heather's phone that says, "If you want to speak to me now, call me. If you want to speak to me, call now. Otherwise, leave me alone forever." And then Heather responds back, "Really? So that's why you're still childishly texting me from your cheating husband's
right after
phone."
This.
And then Sydney's phone responds back to Heather, "Call the number. It's me."
and then had the response back, you call.
Was there anything on the device that indicated that that phone was in Sydney's hand at that time?
No.
How about before that time? Were there phone calls
yes.
and texts before that time, before yes.
341? Yes.
Okay, now how about after that time? Was there text messages after that time?
Well, in the after 4 o'clock, yes.
Okay. So the only time he ain't texting or talking is around 3:41 when the victim's at the landing, correct?
Correct.
Let's bring everyone back in on this case as well. Brian Buckmeyer out in the newsroom. Brian, it sounds to me like the husband, the defendant, is trying to blame the wife who's already been convicted. Are you hearing that?
I'm hearing it as well. And from one angle, I'm not sure how tight the relationship is and not sure how tight it will be after this. There's only so many ways that this case can go down, and pointing the finger at someone else is a strong way to find yourself successful, especially when that other person is already found guilty.
Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson in studio here with me. So, Gwendolyn, look, I mean, you've got the husband, you've got the wife, you've got the girlfriend. This is a real triangle. Why would they allegedly try to lure this young girl out to this random boat launch in the wee hours of the morning?
Well, jealousy. I mean, you have the allegation that this young woman was having an affair with the husband. And, you know, the wife was convicted of the kidnapping, okay? He wasn't, and he's being tried for that, and they're trying to tie him to it at this point.
Okay, Mike Korobanix, we heard the defense during the opening say, there's no motive whatsoever here. And I looked at that and I said, no motive for a husband to get rid of someone he's having an affair with, which angered his wife, and that person he's accused of getting rid of may be pregnant. No motive. That's what the defense said.
Well, there's no better motive than a love triangle. I mean, maybe Jesse Smollett should make a movie of this case because it seems more fitting than his movie.
Who would watch it?
Jesse and his sister.
That's who. Gwendolyn Lindsay Jackson. You know, Sidney Moore case, where do we go from here? Do we expect a little bit more in the weeds here with the text messages and all of that? This has been a case in the weeds. It's been a lot of little what-ifs here and there.
Yeah, you got to get down to the weeds. You're going to have technical experts looking at the text messages, looking at where people were, where the telephone pings came in to place where people were, where the defendant was. All this is going to be very important.
And, of course, the big question mark of exactly where that purported victim is. Her friends haven't seen her. Nobody can find her. Exactly what happened? Well, this is not a murder case. We're going to keep watching it. And thank you for those of us watching The Debrief tonight. We appreciate it. Our live trial coverage here on the Law & Crime Network will pick up tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning. We'll see you then.